live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York Small Pharma is a nonprofit fostering a socially just, environmentally regenerative, and economically inclusive cannabis community. We speak to their board president about their mission and an upcoming cannabis supply chain forum on Saturday. Today is the birthday of Dr. Maya Angelou and the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Janice Adams joins us from The Janice Adams Show with her reflections of these icons and a preview of Saturday's episode. Litter sweep community cleanup teams are coming together and 350 commemorative t-shirts are ready for the fourth annual Upper Delaware Litter Sweep, but volunteers are still needed. We speak to Stephanie Driscoll from the Upper Delaware Council about how you can get involved, and the Wayne Pike Workforce Alliance is offering free digital literacy classes. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A major figure in Israel's war cabinet is calling for early elections. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports this comes as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces mounting challenges over the war in Gaza.
Benny Gantz is the most popular politician in Israel. He's a retired general, a former chief of the military general staff. He was brought into Netanyahu's war cabinet as a moderating influence to instill public trust. Gantz says he wants elections in September, and polls suggest he would defeat Netanyahu handily. This comes days after the largest anti-government demonstration since Israel invaded Gaza, with many protesters also demanding early elections. Netanyahu warns that a political campaign would paralyze the country. He says early elections would stall negotiations to release Israeli hostages and the military's push to defeat Hamas. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Teams in Taiwan are starting to clear wreckage from yesterday's major earthquake. It killed at least 10 people and injured 1,000 others. NPR's Emily Fang is at the epicenter of the Taiwanese quake.
So I'm standing right now in front of a high-rise building that is completely tilted on its side. Workers are piling a huge pile of sand in front of it to stabilize the building before they demolish it later this week. But what's astonishing to me, though, is the rest of the city largely remains untouched despite the violent shaking it suffered throughout much of Wednesday morning. Taiwan does regularly see earthquakes, but it has vastly upgraded and reinforced its infrastructure since a deadly earthquake in 1999. Emily Fang, NPR News, Hualien, Taiwan.
In the U.S., forecasters have issued a winter storm warning for most of New England today. More heavy snow will fall. On the West Coast, California authorities are worried about the scenic Pacific Coast area known as Big Sur. The main highway there is damaged. California officials say some residents could be stranded, and they're urging medically fragile people to evacuate. Stocks opened higher this morning as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen visits China. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 120 points in early trading.
Yellen's visiting the world's second-largest economy for talks on trade, security, and how to compete on a level playing field. The Treasury Secretary told workers at a Georgia solar plant last week she plans to confront her Chinese counterparts about overproduction of clean energy products, including solar panels and electric vehicles. Ford says it's going to wait a little longer before rolling out new models of electric pickup trucks and SUVs. Sales of electric vehicles grew more slowly than other cars and trucks in the first 3 months of the year. Ford does plan to offer more gas-electric hybrids. New applications for unemployment benefits inched up last week. The Labor Department will provide its monthly update on job growth and the March unemployment rate tomorrow. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 120 points. This is NPR. The judge in former President Donald Trump's New York criminal trial on hush money allegations says it will start April 15th. Trump wanted the delay in the trial until after the U.S. Supreme Court rules on whether he's got presidential immunity from prosecution in an entirely different and federal case. Trump has pleaded not guilty in the New York criminal case. A Montana nonprofit organization that helps people find health insurance has become overwhelmed by the tens of thousands of Montana residents who have lost Medicaid. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the group is enlisting other organizations, such as food banks, to help people reapply for coverage.
Roughly 130,000 Montanans lost Medicaid as the state reevaluated everyone's eligibility after the COVID-19 pandemic. Two-thirds lost coverage for procedural reasons, like not filling out paperwork correctly. Cover Montana is helping people reapply, but it's overwhelmed. Olivia Riuda with Cover Montana says it's training other nonprofits, like health clinics or homeless shelters, to help.
We are working to increase the capacity across the state so that these folks who've lost Medicaid can reapply for coverage as quickly as possible.
Similar nonprofits in states like Missouri and Florida have also reported upticks in people who need help getting back on Medicaid. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Columbia Falls, Montana.
Again on Wall Street, the Dow is up a little more than 100 points. The NASDAQ is up nearly 150 points. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. C3.AI. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York Small Pharma is a nonprofit focused on social and economic equity in the adult use cannabis production area, and their hope is to turn the cannabis plant into a vehicle for healing, community well-being, and positive change. They're hosting a cannabis supply chain forum Saturday in Cohasset, and joining us with more is Nicole Ritchie, president of the board of directors of New York Small Pharma. Nicole, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell us more about New York Small Pharma and how you were founded, and more about your vision of using the plant, the cannabis plant, as a vehicle for positive change.
So we were founded by a gentleman by the name of Ben Dobson, who is a hemp farmer and now a cannabis farmer, and Andy Novick, who is a longtime resident of the Hudson River Valley. Both of them are, and Andy is an amazing gardener and regenerative grower, and they founded the organization. And I came on in 2019, and I became the president in, I think, 2021. And we see that cannabis as an ability for positive change, because we believe it can usher in a new paradigm of economic fairness, an inclusivity. I think the New York Program for Social and Economic Equity, which is geared to redress towards communities disproportionately impacted by the drug war, is a huge part of it, making sure that it's economically inclusive and making sure that cannabis is grown in a way that considers the environment, so that we're not, you know, making the same missteps that we did in terms of production and creating an industry that is literally hurting the environment and causing problems for climate change. Cannabis has the ability to sequester carbon and to increase climate resiliency. So for all of those ways, we see it as positive change.
And how do you go about doing that especially regenerative farming? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So regenerative farming is a fancy modern term for returning to the old ways of growing, before industrialization, before tractors, mass spraying, tilling of the ground. What scientists and indigenous people and people who grew long ago knew already was that good crops, healthy crops, start with healthy soil. And healthy soil is created by not disrupting the soil, by allowing the network of biota that live in the soil, the mycelium, the bacteria, the fungi that all live there. They create a network of transportation of energy and nutrients and food to the plants that then take up those plants. And so regenerative farming is a way of working with nature as opposed to against it, as opposed to slashing and spraying and burning. You plant certain plants that are going to attract pests, integrated pest management, and use the natural growth of the plant and the natural flora and fauna to help create a natural system that doesn't require exterior elements of pesticides and fertilizer. And in doing so, you create corridors for pollinators, you sequester carbon, You create a more natural and healthy environment, and you create a better product, a better plant medicine or vegetable, whatever it is that you're choosing to grow regeneratively.
Small farmers are at the heart of what you do, and the New York cannabis law was supposed to offer a lot of opportunity for small farmers and producers and farm co-ops. But even Governor Kathy Hochul called the rollout of the cannabis law and licensing a disaster, and has called off a cannabis control board meeting and asking the board to reevaluate how to fix the mess. What do you think has happened and what could be done, and how's it impacting small farmers from your view?
Well, I think that the entire system is stacked against small farmers. First, I will say, let me just back up and say that there are individuals that work in the Office of Cannabis Management that are truly amazing people, that are dedicated to social and economic equity, that are dedicated to change, that are dedicated to freeing this plant and creating a space for small farmers and making sure that it is equitable. And those people, I feel bad for them when all of this criticism comes out, because they are not the problem. They are really what the glue of what is moving this ship forward. And they're literally building the ship as they move forward, which is created part of the problem. So that being said, the system does tend to stack against, the entire economic system within the U.S. is stacked against small players, and cannabis is no different. We'd like to see a leveling of the playing field, and a lot of that comes from the leadership. The same leadership that is pointing at OCM and criticizing it hasn't really created the funding or the programs to make it successful. It's an understaffed organization. They took on an extremely ambitious, never done before plan. I feel like the board, the Cannabis Control Board, could be way more engaged than they are in the process. And I feel that they need to involve the public and the organizations that are working on the ground in the communities more. Right now, we're allowed to speak for like 120 seconds after all the decisions have been made. They need to start taking testimony and incorporating our testimony into their deliberations, of which they have very little. They just sort of rubber stamp things. So I definitely think a big part of the problem is with the Cannabis Control Board. With all due respect, I respect everyone on that board, but I'm not sure that it is set up in the way that it needs to be and that has the proper input. So that's one thing that we're pushing for, is more transparency on the board and more public input before these decisions are made.
You're gathering folks. Your 2024 New York Farmers Forum and Flower Showcase is Saturday in Cohocton. And this must be a good time for everybody in the industry to come together to talk about, what could be done at that level, but also how to network and view the latest in the industry. Talk a little bit about what the forum's intentions are and how folks can learn more.
Sure. We are very focused on the production tier of cannabis. And so the forum is really to gather farmers together in communities so that they can share their experiences with each other. Mostly farmers rarely leave the farm. They're constantly working from sunup to sundown. They don't even know what day it is. They're just getting stuff done. And so we lure them off the farm together in community, and we really share and learn a lot. And when you get a bunch of cannabis farmers together, you might as well bring out the retailers, because they're going to have their flower with them, and it's a great time to pull the supply chain together. And it's really focused more on community than business, but a lot of business and networking gets done among the industry because the farmers are there with their flower and the retailers can meet them all in one place.
And, one of the other things that you help promote to get folks more educated is you call it a Canna Curious community chat, and that folks can sponsor a community chat. I think one of the things that was interesting I learned from your website was that cannabis was everywhere in New York before it was legalized. How can folks, kind of become more involved?
Sure. Well, we are a small operation, so we are not always able to get to everything that we want. We haven't done a cannabis curious chat, a Canna Curious chat in quite some time, but for sure, if people would like us to host one in their area or on any specific topic, we'll absolutely work with people. They can get in touch with us through the website or through our social media pages, all under our same name, NY Small Pharma. And we're happy to work with the community and set it up and bring information. And we're going to be working on home grow classes moving forward now that home grow will be legal. That regulation is out for comment right now. And we're also working specifically in the county of Ulster to assist. I want to let everyone know that we're working in the county of Ulster to assist applicants for future applications, as well as new licensees, to help launch their operations, to make sure that it's successful and to give them the assistance that they need, especially the social and economic equity licensees.
I mean, before we go, I just wanted to get your take on things. You know, as the New York is sort of retrenching with this, the Office of Cannabis Management, and you guys are focused on regenerative farming and small farming. Are you feeling like this is a pivot point and things are looking better for the industry as a whole?
I would love to say yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it's a yes and no question. Things are definitely looking better for the industry as a whole because the wheel is starting to actually make a turn, but we are not out of the woods. There are, you know, large special interests, big corporations, registered organizations, huge amounts of money that are moving in. And I can't impress upon everyone enough that the legislators are not funding the social and economic equity. They did fund one program called the Cannabis Workforce Initiative, which is an amazing program run by Dave Serrano. And that does bring a lot of good assistance to the community, but it is not enough, in particular in the production tier. We need to have low and zero interest loans available. We need to have grants available, research available, and we definitely need organizations like New York Small Pharma and our colleagues funded so that we can offer incubators that provide the expertise and support that these small farmers need. You know, farmers, just to be able to package their zucchini or to sell their zucchini, it takes a toll. It takes them away from the work of growing it. So they need assistance for those types of aspects in the supply chain, and especially in a brand new industry, a brand new crop that's coming out. And so the legislators have to move on the budget and fund these programs. And we really implore individuals to support the press conference that's happening today in Albany at 11 a.m., to call your senator, call your assembly member, and tell them to fund the social and economic equity provisions of the cannabis law.
Nicole Ricci is the president of the board of directors of New York Small Pharma. There's more information about their vision and what they do at nysmallpharma.org. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, litter sweep on the Upper Delaware and how you can get involved. Volunteers are still needed. We'll get more about how you can get involved right after this break. It's Radio Chatskill.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's new show, Electric Mountain. I play the best of dance music from back in the day to today, and every week I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set, bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain each and every Saturday night, 12 to 2, exclusively on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hello, my name is John Gordon, and I host a music show right here on WJFF called Ramble Tamble. It airs every Thursday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. I love music, and I play all kinds of different music. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday night, 7 to 9, right here on WJFF.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, community cleanup teams are coming together, and the commemorative T-shirts have been printed for the 4th annual Upper Delaware Litter Sweep, but we still need some volunteers to help out. Stephanie Driscoll from the Upper Delaware Council is here to tell us about how you can get involved. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. How are things coming together for Litter Sweep?
Everything's going great. I mean, the weather today might make you think that it's not spring, but it is.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
I know. The litter sweep is upon us, though. We have litter sweep dates scheduled for the 15 towns and townships all the way from April 14th to April 30th, surrounding Earth Day. So it's moving right along.
Now, let's remind folks how this comes together. You know, this is all volunteer. Like, folks come together and in their towns and townships decide, hey, we're going to do this, and then they're going to clean up their portion, right?
Yes. So each town and township, a litter leader comes forward, and they organize within their town or township, and the UDC provides all of the supplies, and we do all of the like applications for DOT and the county levels. So we help them organize it, but the litter leaders really pull their weight.
And these litter leaders and these volunteers are everyone from individuals to groups to businesses. What you still need volunteers. Talk a little bit about like what you need and where you need it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got quite a few towns and townships already scheduling their litter sweeps, but we still need volunteers. We'll always need volunteers. And, you know, it doesn't have to be in your town or township, or if you, you know, don't live here, you're more than welcome to participate in any of them. So volunteers are always needed everywhere, but specifically for the litter sweep. I mean, if you are looking to clean up this beautiful river corridor, we're looking for you.
Yeah, and that is this is the time of the year where we all come together to do that, to make the corridor better for all of us. And, you know, this is, again, a volunteer effort. Where can folks get the information about how to become a litter leader or participate?
Of course. So they would come straight to me. You can either call us at 845-252-3022 or email me at stephanie@upperdelawarecouncil.org, and I will put you in touch with the litter leader for the town and township you're looking for, or if you're interested in becoming a litter leader, I can give you all the information for that. So reach out to me.
And you also accept donations if someone isn't able to maybe be a litter leader.
Of course, yes. We accept donations of any amount and goods and services as well.
Okay, they call you to get the info on that. But let's talk about those T-shirts. I just saw them online. They're really cool. Tell us about the T-shirts and who designed them.
Yeah, we're very excited about the T-shirts. They are Safety Pink this year. They are featuring artwork by Philadelphia artist Eric Hinckley on the front, the UDC logo on the back, and WJFF Radio's logo on the sleeve as our media sponsor. So we are very excited. We ordered 350 of them in all various sizes. We are prepared for a lot of volunteers,
yes.
So hopefully we get them.
Collectible. You have to be a litter leader or litter volunteer to have one, and we're very happy and proud to partner with you on this great effort in our community, the Upper Delaware Litter Sweep, the fourth annual. And, get involved, help keep this area beautiful for everyone. Stephanie, one more time, how folks can get in touch with you.
Sure, absolutely. So you can call the UDC office at 845-252-3022, or you can call, or email me at stephanie@upperdelawarecouncil.org.
And anything else you want to add before we go?
No, I'm just, we're excited, and we hope that everybody else is excited as well. And we have a great turnout this year, and we're hoping everybody wants to get involved.
And correct me if I'm wrong, was this one of your first times on the radio?
This is one of my first times on the radio and my first time with the litter sweep. So.
All right. Okay, you're doing a great job on both, so congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie Driscoll from the Upper Delaware Council talking to us about fourth annual litter sweep. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, learn how you can get free digital literacy classes at the Wayne Pike Workforce Alliance. Right after this, it's Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As education, healthcare, job search, and even grocery shopping move deeper and deeper into the digital age, people have had to develop a new set of skills to navigate an increasingly technological and global society. From connecting with services to connecting with peers, a person's ability to flourish and thrive can be challenged by a lack of access to technology and a lack of skills. Officials call this the digital divide, and there are two groups in Wayne County that are working together to close this gap. Joining us now to talk about it is Alexa Chalia from Wayne Pike Workforce Alliance. She's the education specialist there. Alexa, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for being here. And, you know, I described how there's this increasingly technological and global society. Don't we all know it? What is digital literacy considered? What we talk about like how people are challenged by technology and a lack of skills. Is that what that means?
Yes. So digital literacy is the knowledge and skill sets that allow you to efficiently use technology in our ever-increasing digital age. Our focus is on digital fundamentals such as computer basics, navigating and browsing the internet, using business applications such as Microsoft Office, as well as a focus on digital job seeking, teaching individuals how to successfully create and save resumes, applying for jobs, and navigate job boards.
How did the Wayne Pike Workforce Alliance get involved with this effort?
Well, at Workforce Alliance, we create educational opportunities that build our community and encourage lifelong learning. We help you learn and skill up, which allows you to get better opportunities, and digital literacy is now a fundamental part of that skill development. When the digital literacy grant was announced, it was just a natural choice to apply for the grant and help members of the community develop these skills. We actually just submitted our grant proposal that would continue this program for another 2 years.
And so far, it's been successful. Are you having a lot of people involved, and they're happy to get some literacy tips?
Yes, we need to get the program out there more to get more people to attend. But so far, the people that come, the seeing their eyes light up when that spark of understanding hits, has been wonderful.
Well, that's why we're talking today. Then tell us more about your partnership with the libraries in Wayne and Pike Counties.
Well, the Wayne Library Alliance provides training space at 7 library locations, and it assists in outreach efforts to identify participants. They're a wonderful help letting members of the community know that this program exists and promoting it. It's also a huge help for participants that can't travel to our office in Holmesdale. And because the libraries are located throughout Wayne and Pike counties, we can help more people and decrease the transportation barrier.
You know, you mentioned people that have taken these courses and their eyes light up. So what types of people, what types of help can you offer people so that their eyes do light up?
Well, we offer everything from computer basics, including hardware and software understanding, safely browsing and navigating the internet, your smartphone, online job hunting, resumes, navigating job boards, professional networking, and even interviewing skills.
And is it a group session? Are these one-on-one sessions? How does it work?
Both. I currently hold scheduled group trainings at the libraries 2 to 3 times a week, with the curriculum changing from week to week. They're posted on both ours and the library's websites and social media. And you do have to register for those. But I'm also available for one-on-one training. So if anyone wants individual training, just call me and I can schedule a session either in my office or at a library close to you.
And, you know, if I wanted to come into one of the classes, what kinds of, I mean, I have a feeling that there might be some people that are maybe timid or afraid just because of this digital divide, right? And they're not confident about their skills. But what is it you want people to know about the fact that you have these classes and that you're willing to work with them?
There's nothing to be afraid of. We provide laptops, tablets, smartphones for people to work on, and everyone's in the same boat. So it's all about getting you comfortable and feeling that you could live in the digital age.
Yeah, I know there are times when I think, oh, I've got it. And then something confounds me and I'm like, I don't know anything. So things are, it's great to have this free class on digital literacy in the area. You know, we mentioned you're the education specialist for Wayne Pike Workforce Alliance. I think when we think of Workforce Alliance, we think more of, economic development, business, but this is really the people side of that. And so why is it important for workforce development to be involved with this and to offer these classes?
Well, as job recruitment and placement methods have evolved, the need for digital literacy has increased. They're now necessary for job searching capabilities, access to employment listings, and securing and maintaining jobs and careers that offer family sustainable wages. the residents of Wayne and Pike counties have limited access to educational programs harboring their professional, occupational, and vocational needs. So this program aims to fill that void by providing access to education and resources for our community. It helps you develop the fundamental skills to maintain and succeed in the workplace.
You know, I just wanted to ask, you know, from your experience with having these classes and the folks that come in, any particular sort of aha moment that someone shared with you after taking one of the classes?
Well, we had three people get hired for their resume skills afterwards.
Oh, that's great.
Definitely has stuck with me.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, that's what it's all about. Also, anything else at the Wayne Pike Workforce Alliance that you want folks to know about?
Well, to reach out, you can visit us at wpworkforce.org. And our grants cover most of our trainings and services. However, there are different areas that provide after-school programming and helps with youth from kindergarten to adulthood, many of which struggle with food insecurities, which we do take donations for. And if you're a business in PA, you can also donate through the EITC, which gives you a 90% tax credit.
All right. And let's remind folks again where they can get that information and register for those digital literacy classes.
If you could call at 570-390-7613 or visit us at wpworkforce.org.
And again, how often are these offered for folks?
Anytime you could call for an individual one-on-one, and they are offered 2 to 3 times a week at the libraries throughout Wayne and Pike County.
All right, that's great. Alex Chalia from the Wayne Pike Workforce Alliance. She's the education specialist. We've been talking about the free digital literacy classes offered there. Alexa,
thank you so much.
I keep calling you Alex. Alexa, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll take a break and back with more Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Matt Hurtado. Join me on a journey where pixels meet melodies and controllers become conductors. This is Virtual Soundscapes, the show that transports you to the sonic realms of video game magic. In this journey, we'll uncover the hidden treasures of video game soundtracks from the classics to modern day, and speak with industry veterans. Join me every Thursday night at 10 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hey, it's Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe.
One of the things you can count on from NPR and this station, we've got your back when it comes to reporting the news, bringing you facts you can count on. You can help by donating a vehicle you no longer need.
That car could be worth hundreds of dollars in support or more as a donation.
Think about it.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York State lawmakers are resuming budget negotiations in Albany starting today. Governor Kathy Hochul doesn't seem too concerned about missing the deadline as talks go on. WAMC's Ian Pickus spoke to Albany reporter John Campbell from the New York Public News Network.
Well, Governor Hochul has made pretty clear since she took office in 2021 that she isn't terribly concerned about the budget deadline, quite frankly. I mean, this is her third budget since she took office, and this is the third one that's going to be late. And, you know, there aren't a ton of immediate consequences from that. They did pass a budget extender to essentially fund government through April 4th, and that'll ensure that state workers will get paid, which is the biggest deal on the when the budget runs out. But it, you know, it's a rite of passage in Albany for a late budget. There were some exceptions during Andrew Cuomo's tenure because he tried to make on-time budgets a symbol of government functioning. But, you know, for the most part, dating back to the 70s and 80s, budgets have been regularly late, and that is going to be the case again this year as well.
How far apart are one, both chambers in the legislature, the state assembly and the Senate, and then the legislature as a whole with the governor on coming together on a spending plan?
Well, when we spoke to Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie this week, he made it, his analogy was planetary. He said, sometimes when you're negotiating a budget, you're not in the same galaxy. And in this case, they're on the, in the same galaxy, but perhaps not the same state or country. So, you know, this is something that, in general, they are pretty close on the big picture, right? Like, they all want housing in the budget, housing policy in the budget. And, you know, they, but perhaps they differ on exactly how they'd get there. Governor Hochul has been focused more on supply, while the legislature has been focused more on tenant protections. And it's looking like there could be paths to compromise for that and on issues like education funding and Medicaid funding, but they're not quite there yet. And even if they were to strike a deal, you know, tomorrow, it would still take quite some time to put the bills together and to actually get them through a vote. So we've got some time left here before they actually have a final budget.
Now, let's take a couple of those big items that you mentioned one by one, the first being housing. Governor Hochul last year pushed for an ambitious housing plan, and that didn't quite make it through the legislature. And the housing shortages and price of housing continue to be an issue for many New Yorkers. So how certain are you that the governor and the legislature will come to agreement on a large housing deal in the new budget?
Well, housing seems to be the biggest thing holding things up to a broader budget deal at this point. And part of that is because there are so many layers to be negotiated here. I mean, the governor's big push has been to require local governments to create new housing or to commit to creating new housing if they want to be eligible for certain state grants, like, say, the Downtown Revitalization Initiative, where local governments can compete for a $10 million grant to revitalize their downtowns. And the governor comes to town with a big check, a big fancy $10 million check, and you get to work. So the governor wants to make it so you have to commit to being a pro-housing community to be eligible for that. So it's, you know, there's that part of it. But really the big part now is, are these negotiations over a tax break for New York City developers. No
funding and a pitch by the governor to tweak the formula from which school districts would receive aid. What can you tell me about those discussions, and do you think that the governor and the legislature can come to agreement?
Yeah, the governor has two major changes that she wants to make. One is she wants to get rid of a measure known as Hold Harmless. And that was basically, it's a longstanding measure by which, you know, you plug, the state has these complicated formulas to determine how much money each school district gets from the state. You know, the state spends more than $30 billion a year on education. And there was a provision that said, basically, if you plug in those numbers and a school district is supposed to get less aid than they got the year before, they're held harmless. They get the same amount as they got the year before. So the governor wants to get rid of that. And she says, essentially, you know, there are a lot of districts that have been losing enrollment. So why are they getting the same amount of money that they did in previous years? But by changing that, by getting rid of that, nearly half of the state's more than 600 school districts would actually see less funding than they did the year before. And that's unpalatable to many state lawmakers who really pride themselves on being able to go to Albany and bring home the bacon for their school districts and their local governments. So lawmakers have pushed back very hard against that. There's another provision that the governor wants that would change the way they calculate inflation. It would smooth it out over a 10-year period so you wouldn't see big spikes in school aid when there are big spikes, annual spikes in inflation. The legislature seems a little more open to that. That is one that's still being negotiated at this point. And you saw some comments this week from Senate Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins that kind of suggested that maybe the legislature's willing to play ball on that a little bit. But again, this is all happening behind the scenes in these closed door negotiations. So we just have to kind of get these little dribs and drabs from lawmakers and the governor when they actually speak to the media.
Now, John, you also mentioned Medicaid. There's been a discussion ongoing about a raise that home health care aides would get, whether it's 1.5% or 3%. Are lawmakers and the governor coming together on a raise for home health care aides?
Yeah, that's one of the things that is under negotiation. There's, you know, home health care aides are pushing for an increase in Medicaid, an increase in their rate and Medicaid reimbursements. The hospitals are pushing for the same thing, and the nursing homes are pushing for the same thing. But all of that costs a considerable amount of money. You know, the state spends, again, $30 billion on Medicaid, just like they do on education, and it makes up a huge chunk of the state budget. One thing that lawmakers are pushing is this tax on health plans. And the idea would be to you tax them, you put that money into the Medicaid system, and then the federal government matches it. Budget watchers say, well, maybe that'll work. It worked in California, but the federal government has warned that they might change that formula in the future because it doesn't really go with the spirit of the law. So there are some budget watchers who think they might be playing with fire if that's the case, that maybe they get it initially, but then the federal government disallows it in future years, and then you're right back to trying to figure out how to pay for it. But that's all being negotiated as we speak.
So, John, one of the items that didn't make it out of the legislature last year, although the governor has included some of its language in her proposal, is what we call the New York HEAT Act. That's legislation related to the electrification of homes and moving new buildings off of fossil fuels. What's the status with negotiations there?
Well, the Senate passed that in recent weeks, just as they did last year. And that's, you know, the big thing that would do is get rid of what's known as the 100-foot rule, which is basically, there's a rule right now that says if you're within 100 feet of a natural gas main and you want natural gas hookups in your house, the utility has to provide that to you free of charge, and the cost gets distributed among all utility ratepayers. So that is, getting rid of that rule would kind of move the state more toward its goal of bringing more and more renewable energy into the fold. And it's been pushed by environmental groups for years now to try to make that happen. The state has its own climate goals that are very ambitious, and right now they perhaps aren't on track to hit them. So they need things like this in order to hit the goals. The governor surprised some people in January when she kind of included the bulk of that in her budget proposal. But the assembly hasn't, at least publicly, got on board yet. They did not pass it when the Senate passed it last year. They have not passed a version of that bill yet. It has been involved in some level of budget negotiations, but whether it makes it into the final budget remains to be seen. That said, if it doesn't, it still could come up before lawmakers end their legislative session in June.
So, of course, it is a presidential election year. John, what's the role politics is playing in New York State budget negotiations?
Well, politics always plays some level of role in budget negotiations or anything that happens in Albany, because lawmakers are up for election every 2 years. So, you know, there's certainly, you could argue politics comes into play with the education funding, because there's no way that lawmakers would want to go back to their districts in an election year and, you know, say that their local districts got less money than they did the year before. That would be fodder for their opponents. Another example is, you know, Governor Hochul, since 2022, has really, really tried to paint herself as being tough on crime. And in part, that's because Lee Zeldin, her Republican opponent, used that issue against her in a very effective way in 2022, when Governor Hochul won by only 5.5 points. So, you know, she has pushed criminal justice changes in recent years. One that she's pushing this year is a measure that would increase penalties for assaulting a retail worker. That does not look like it's going to get through. The legislature is pretty averse to increasing criminal penalties, and that is certainly the case on this as well. But, you know, it's another signal that Governor Hochul is trying to paint herself as tough on crime.
WNYC's John Campbell, who has his eye on all things Albany. Thanks so much, John. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Lucas.
And that was WAMC's Lucas Ward. I misidentified him in the introduction. Speaking to WNYC's John Campbell about the latest on the budget in Albany. That's from the New York Public News Network. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And today does mark the birthday of Dr. Maya Angelou, and also marks the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Here to talk to us about her reflections of these two icons and also to preview what's coming up on the Janice Adams Show this Saturday is Janice Adams. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Hi, Tim. Hi, everybody.
You made it through the snow.
We made it through the storms.
We wanted to talk about this, Dr. Maya Angelou's birthday and the anniversary of Dr. King's death today. You know, Dr. Angelou was a friend of yours, a mentor.
Yes. I mean, she really was a friend. I was very, very fortunate. I call her a sister, mother, friend, as well as a mentor. I was really in graduate school when I met her, and my graduate degree is the nation's first graduate degree in Black studies. And I met her in the course of working on it. And she was so fascinated that, and she was not the Maya Angelou at the, mm-hmm. at that point. In fact, she was just, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings was just about to come out, and that's why she was in New York starting to talk it up before pub date. And she was just so fascinated that not only was I taking that degree or creating that degree, but that I was in her stomping ground of San Francisco, Oakland area. Mm. And so that kind of bonded us from that period on.
And, you know, she would have been 96 today. And we mentioned also that it's the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King today. And for many years, she was impacted
traumatized because she absolutely was traumatized by the idea that he was assassinated on her birthday.
And she wouldn't celebrate her birthday, really.
It changed her forever in terms of just thinking about the horror of that. It did.
What are your reflections about Dr. King on this anniversary day?
Well, I have a more joyful reflection because being, you know, I mentioned this degree, and I think the importance of this is here we are in a point where school desegregation is under attack again. Black studies is under attack. This racist assault. My whole life from 8 years old has been conscripted into school desegregation and changing the education environment. And so I'm one of the first children who desegregated the New York City public schools, which led the way for the North. And because of that, when Dr. King came to town when I was 10, I was introduced to him. And it was just absolutely, I mean, for me, it was, I had gotten increasingly shy by that period because of that desegregation experience. It was not pleasant, but he literally lifted my chin. And this was the young dad. You know, we forget how young these people were. Dr. King and Malcolm were killed at 39. So we're talking about a man who's like in his late 20s. Is what I'm talking about. And he's a brand new father. And so he lifts my chin to his and he says some nice little girl things, but he asks, and he knows, what are you doing for our people? And I say that I'm helping with the schools. And he says, and he tells me that what I'm doing is extremely important. And he tells me that because of what I'm doing, no other children will have to suffer this going forward. I am traumatized by that, to think that he then makes a promise. He has us make a vow, and he says, okay, we're going to make a pact. If you keep doing what you're doing, then I will keep doing what I am doing for our people. And that's the pact that he makes with a 10-year-old. And here we are, as I say, and America has broken that pact.
And as a 10-year-old, you know, it has to be overwhelming, amazing to meet someone, this iconic figure. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, how did you come to understand who he was and what he was doing for our people, as he says. How did you come to understand what it was he was talking about at that time?
Well, first of all, my it's the time after Rosa Parks has desegregated. That's what propels him to the international stage. And the family has been following, even though we're in New York, we have been, my family was following that step by step all along. So we were aware of what was going on with the Montgomery movement. And part of that, and now I know as an adult, as a historian, having done the research, that literally the day that Rosa Parks refuses, the day that she goes to court for having refused to give up her seat, at that exact date, exact time, my grandmother is in federal court in New York to become a citizen. And as a result, my family, a West Indian immigrant family, a Caribbean immigrant family, kind of pledges its only two grandchildren to the movement, saying in honor of my grandmother and saying they're making things better. So it was very much part of our household to be talking about it. But once I was part of the school desegregation movement, every day your parents had to kind of coax you and, you know, cuddle you into the strength to be able to go back for the next day. And I know that we had a conversation where my dad was telling me about all the good things that were going to happen. And I remember saying something like granny, so like granny nanny, and granny nanny was a Revolutionary War, a warrior of the Maroon people trying to free us from enslavement. And just like Rosa Parks and just like this. So I had been also being trained and groomed in Black history, in American history, but in Black history.
So having meeting Dr. King at that time, did that then strengthen you and make this mark on you?
It has made a mark on me ever since. And the mark was galvanized on this date of his assassination.
Hmm. We want to talk about the Janice Adams Show coming up this Saturday and that episode. What do you have for this Saturday at 11?
Well, this Saturday I'm excited to actually, it's a whole different vibe here, but it's important. It's Team Dream is what we're featuring this Saturday. And it's the story of two women who at ages 76 and 82 trained to be elite swimmers and join the National Senior Games. And they have been extraordinary. And so a film was done about them. And that's what we're featuring, is an interview with those two women and the director of the film. And then also Kevin Dawson joins us for a brief clip of this to kind of put in perspective African-American swimming history.
We've got a little clip of that, a little preview of the Janice Adams Show Saturday at 11. Here's a clip.
Before the invention of the telescope, the Dogon people of Mali, West Africa, sighted a rare star, later called Sirius B, a little star of great importance. So imagine then how I felt at this year's Martha's Vineyard African American Film Festival when a little star of a film, Team Dream, flared with great importance, capturing imaginations, changing the way we think of African Americans and swimming, changing lives and self-perceptions, taking us beyond our fears to the essence of joy, Black joy.
Black people can't swim. I don't buy that. I come from a history of swimmers. I am Madeline Murphy Rabb, 76 years young.
I am Ann Smith, and I am 82.
We're training for the National Senior Games.
Team Dream,
two women who decide as senior citizens to become competitive swimmers. Why swimming? Why is it so important?
My great aunt told me that her father, who was a former slave,
Ann Smith,
went to Cornersville, Tennessee, to start a school and to start a church after he had attended what was the beginnings of Fisk University. He had 18 children, and he told them, one of you is going to live to be 100, and one of his daughters lived to be 99. And when she told me that story, I decided, well, I think that I will achieve his dream. I will live to be 100. And I knew that in order to do that, you had to be healthy. You have to eat correctly. You have to use your body efficiently and all the time. Now, whether or not I will live to be 100, I don't know, but I am certainly striving to do that. And so for me, the swimming and all the athletic things that I do are because I want to be healthy, because I would just like to live to be 100, but I would also like to live to be 100 enjoying these later years. And I know that I can if I'm healthy.
Madeline, what about you?
I'm driven and I'm very competitive with myself. And frankly, when I think about it, Anne has been a huge influence on me because I introduced her to Derek.
Derek Milligan, their coach.
And then I look up and Anne has casually mentioned that she's got some medals. And I'm saying, you have what? And I had been telling Derek, who early on told me that he thought that I was an athlete and that I could compete. And nobody had ever really told me that. Although my family was very athletic, it wasn't something that we focused on. We focused on civil rights, education, you know, until Derek. And then this Ann Smith person, you know, gets all these medals. And I'm like a spoiled brat, I must admit. I want some medals. And she just, you know, Anne is so mellow and so cool. And she says, okay, calm down. I'm going to get you some medals. You know.
That is a clip from this Saturday's episode of the Janice Adams Show. Team Dream, the story of two women ages 76 and 82 who trained as elite swimmers to join the National Senior Games. Yes. A great story. Thanks for bringing us to that clip, and we look forward to hearing the full episode Saturday at 11.
Saturday at 11, airing and streaming live here on WJFF, and then the following Saturday, we hope you'll join us for the fund drive.
Exactly.
The fund drive.
We're putting the fun in fund drive. Janice Adams, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Tim.
And again, Janice Adams shows airs Saturday at 11 and streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Tomorrow on Radio Chatskill, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government will be here with the latest news from Monticello. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Awful Radio Catskill support.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. Afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, a winter weather advisory, remains in effect until 8 a.m. tomorrow for Sullivan County and northern Wayne County. Could see an additional inch of snow after 10 o'clock this morning, or this afternoon. Plan on slippery road conditions, and the hazardous conditions could affect us later this afternoon. Call 511 for road conditions in the state you're traveling in.